Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. This week, before I get to my guest, who, by the way, is a little off the beaten path, really cool conversation with somebody that I think you're going to find really interesting. Come see me doing stand-up this weekend, April 13th to the 15th. I'm going to be at the Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan. Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle, famous club, been around 30 years. Tim Allen got a start there and was discovered there. Louis Black plays there all the time. Really great club. It's in Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. Hope you can make it. Love the crowds there. Have a great time. It's Easter weekend. We'll have chocolate bunnies. We'll get stomach aches, and then we'll laugh. And April 27th to the 29th, I'm at Comics Comedy Club in Mohegan Sun. Comics Comedy Club, April 27th to the 29th. At the Mohegan Sun, it's a casino in Connecticut. You come, you gamble, you'll go bankrupt, but then you'll forget you went bankrupt because you'll be laughing a lot. So it all works out. And keep putting up reviews of the podcast. If you've already done it, please tell your friends on iTunes. You just go there, you give a little positive love, and it's always good to have that up there. And keep spreading the word and tell your friends, family about the podcast, because we want to keep this thing growing. The numbers are growing really great, and that's thanks to you guys. And enjoy this conversation with Dr. Annette Nunez, a autism specialist and expert. Really interesting conversation, and we'll see you next week. We have a very special guest this week, Dr. Annette Nunez, and she is an autism expert, author, and founder of Breakthrough Interventions, which is a sort of multidimensional therapeutic program that specializes in one-on-one programs at home and in school for children with autism. And we're here to talk about autism and where things are with that condition these days. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being on with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, you have a book out called Friendship Is, which is a children's book that's designed to teach children the importance of friendship and the fact that children with autism share the same need. And you know, I'm struck by, we want to talk about the book a little bit, but also the Sesame Street has a new character.
Yes.
Which I wanted to get your thoughts on, and if you were aware that it was coming before the public knew it was coming.
Yes, yes, yes. Julia.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic because it really teaches, you know, kids at a young age, teaching inclusion and empathy and compassion starts at a young age. So I think the earlier you can promote it, educate children about autism, the more compassion they have when they get older, and the more they'll include children with autism into classrooms, into the public, into society. And so I think it's a great thing that Sesame Street added in a character with autism.
Had that been in the works for a while? I mean, were experts like yourself consulted on that, or how did that come about?
I know that, from what I understand, I know that they did a lot of research on creating her character, which I think is wonderful. And, you know, there is a famous quote that if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. So although...
Meaning that every person with autism is different. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And you'll never meet one person with autism that's exactly the same as another person.
Right.
So, you know, when creating the character, it's great. I think they have some of the characteristics of autism, but that necessarily is not what autism looks like. I mean, it's a spectrum disorder. So you have kids on the low functioning end, adults on the low functioning end, all the way to the high functioning end. And then there's, you know, the kids in the middle, the kids and the adults in the middle. So it really is a spectrum disorder when we're looking at it.
Right. My brother runs the, he runs a unit at Brad. I don't know if you're familiar with Bradley Hospital in Riverside, Rhode Island. They work with the severely autistic children. And he's been doing that for 35, going on almost 40 years. And these are children that who are not able to be at home. They have to be in this private home because you know, they have to work, a lot of them wearing helmets because they tend to self-abuse. Describe that kind of person to the lay person who's listening. Like, what? How is that person categorized on the spectrum of autism? And
So the DSM-5 just recategorized everything. So they have it divided into levels, level 1, level 2, and level 3. Mm. And level 1 is more of the extreme end, meaning, you know, you have the kids that are nonverbal. They have extreme behaviors such as self-injurious behaviors that could include them banging their heads against the wall, against tables, against the floor, against their fists. It's very, very dangerous, self-injurious behavior. And these children have a really hard time functioning in the environment because it may be overstimulating. Their need for routine is very, very intense and extreme. So when you interrupt their routine, they become violent. They can become violent, not in a conscious way where they're out to hurt you, but more because the environment in itself is too extreme for them to handle. And the only way that they can deal with it is doing self-injurious behaviors or lashing out at others.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the times they don't have the verbal capabilities to express, I'm frustrated, I'm mad, this hurts me. And so it becomes really extreme behaviors such as aggression. And like I said, like the head banging, the biting, kicking, falling to the floor, screaming, and that's a really extreme, extreme, extreme severe case. You know, and then you have like the middle end, which those kids have language. Academically, they do well. They need some support in a school environment. They can function and live independently, probably in an assisted living program. And then you have the high end, and those are the kids that are fully functioning. They can function in a mainstream environment with little to no support. They can go on and live independently and lead successful lives, or quote unquote successful lives, whatever is considered successful, you know?
Right.
And those are the people that live on their own, that can live independently and hold jobs and things like that.
And, I've always found that autism is sort of, I mean, all, you know, sort of, various forms of sort of, you know, mental, non-well-being, if you will, sort of is challenging. But autism sort of, especially those with that sort of are on the more severe end of the spectrum, they're not very communicative. So how do you know if and when you're getting through to those kids, and how do you see development happening with them?
So, you know, the importance is really stressed on early intervention. So when we get kids in our program, the majority of the time we get them at a very young age. Mm-hmm. We get them anywhere from 1 to 5 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And many of our kids come to us and they're nonverbal. So the program that we do is based on the foundations of applied behavior analysis, which is ABA. And we break down skills and teach them the foundations of how to communicate. So it starts off with simple sounds. So if we know a child is babbling and saying things like ma, 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 or ba, 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 we actually shape those sounds into words so it becomes mama or ball or baby, and we turn those words into meaningful language for them. So it starts off with simple sounds, then what one-word utterances, then two-word utterances, then statements like I want play, I want eat, I see tree. So our program focuses on teaching kids the foundations of language, such as verbs and nouns, where quote-unquote typical kids pick up naturally. We actually teach our kids those skills and break them down in such so they can learn. As now, when you get a nonverbal kid, you really have to be a mind reader, and you have to think, you know, do they need to go to the bathroom? Are they hungry? Are they thirsty? You know, is their stomach hurting? Is the environment overstimulating? And you almost have to rule those things out. So when somebody who doesn't have those verbal capabilities is tantruming, you really have to go through the checklist and offer them water, food. And usually the majority, where it's trending on the lower end, they have communication devices, and there's iPads that you can use with programs that will actually, they can point to icons and it will verbally speak like I'm thirsty or I want drink. And so that's their means of communication. But when we get a nonverbal child, we really work on the communication piece, because that's huge. A lot of those tantrums and meltdowns come from the lack of communication and frustration from it. So it's a very intense program of what we do and in teaching kids how to communicate.
Are tantrums more prevalent with children with or people with autism versus sort of those with other other sort of forms of mental illness or handicap?
Yes. Yeah, that's actually a very good question. The way we look at autism and the way I define autism is a behavioral disorder. So, you know, define that as
vis-a-vis behavioral versus a mental disorder. Make a distinction for me.
Yeah, so, you know, in the definition of it is a developmental disability, which is true. It does affect the development of, you know, communication and milestones. However, when we look at a child with autism and you look at their behaviors, some of their behaviors come from attention-seeking ways. So sometimes when a child is tantruming or headbanging, what do? You go up to that child and you'll say, are you okay? What's wrong? You hug. You give that attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
So over time, they learn to communicate via tantruming. So they tantrum, they get attention, they calm down. And it's almost we have to reverse that effect in the sense of we have to reinforce the behavior that's appropriate. So we work on, if a child is tantruming, we work on quiet. And as soon as they start becoming quiet, that's when we start giving attention. Like, that's good calming down. That's good. We don't say regulating, but that's good staying quiet. That's great. And we almost have to teach them to regulate their behaviors.
So they're able to make a cause and effect between if I, like a child without this problem or even an animal in the sense, like if I do this bad thing, then I know I'm not going to get something. So I'm going to stop doing this bad thing. So I get this thing that I want. They're able to do that. So is that?
It's basically all attention seeking and reinforcement. So you really want to reinforce the appropriate behavior and kind of ignore, if you will, the inappropriate behavior. So let me give you an example. Children with autism, and this may be an overgeneralization, but the majority of children with autism love iPads or they love any type of technology. When you take the technology away, they usually will have a huge tantrum.
And why do they love it? Is it just so visually stimulating?
Yeah, it's visually stimulating. It's a routine. It's kind of rote. It's very structured. It's predictable.
And that's good for children. From what my brothers told me, that's good for children with autism. It's structured.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Structure. They love the structure. They love the routine.
Is that
they love predictability.
Is that Rain Man? Is that character in Rain Man fairly accurate to what people see? Yeah.
Well, with some of the kids, yes. You know, a lot of our clients now, autism looks a little different. We're getting kids that are much more social and don't have like that rote talk of language, but they actually can communicate and they have more affect. But you know, when you take an iPad away from a child, the probably 90% of the time they're going to tantrum. And so, you know, if it's a real tantrum, like where they're hurt or they're hungry, because they will continue crying. But if you were to give that iPad right back to that child, that tantrum would stop immediately. So those are the types of things that we look for when we look in working with kids is that tantrum, a function because it's something that they want and they're not getting their way, or is it because they're hurt and they're hungry? So we really work on that, but we also teach the self-regulation piece as well.
And you're able to see progress over time. Is there such a thing as sort of relapses or sort of setbacks where kids sort of,
You know, 90% of my kids in my practice are fully mainstreamed into school, into mainstream classrooms with little to no support. Where we do see regression is when they hit their teen years because of the hormones. And it's not a significant regression, but, you know, they may start doing things that they did when they were little, such as maybe hand flapping or lining things up or being really emotional about things. The other thing that we see is kind of cyclical in the sense of during spring, sometimes our clients have a hard time. And the beauty of it, though, is if we know a client is going through a hard time, then right immediately after that hard time, it's like they have this spike and they come out of it better than what they that they were before they entered that kind of regression, if you will. But it's never to the extreme of where a child has language and all of a sudden they've lost language. It's nothing like that. It's more behavioral stuff, mm-hmm. as in terms of being more emotional, having to have things very rigid. They become very rigid. So we see regression as in terms of that self-stimulatory behavior, meaning that they may start hand flapping or pacing more. And we kind of see that like in spring or fall as the seasons change, that's when we kind of see those little dips in regression. But it's nothing extreme.
Why is it tied to seasons?
You know, it's interesting. You know, we have some clients and we work with our clients over years. So we kind of understand and know their pattern. Some children have a little dip and fall, and we don't know why. We don't know if it's the season change or daylight savings. Some have it in spring, and we don't know if it's the pollen in the air or what causes it. But it is very interesting because we'll have a set of clients that will have this little dip or regression in fall, and then another set that will have a dip and regression in spring. And so what we try to do is be proactive. If we noticed a pattern over the years, mm-hmm. that we say, oh, little Johnny, we know he's going to have a little dip in spring, so let's be more proactive.
And what is the sort of the line between Asperger's and autism? I know sort of as a lay person, it's sort of the person with Asperger's is sort of highly functional, and it's almost, mm-hmm. you wouldn't, mm-hmm. maybe the average person wouldn't notice it. But what, talk about some of the distinctions there.
Yeah, well, the DSM-5, unfortunately, has got rid of the diagnosis of Asperger's, but we still use that to describe very, very, very high-functioning people with autism. And Asperger's, these individuals are fully functioning. They talk. They're highly articulate, very bright. They struggle socially, though. You know, kind of maybe they're the odd person in school where they're extremely bright, extremely smart, but they're a little just off or odd socially, and they may say inappropriate things or may not get jokes. Those are individuals most likely that have Asperger's, and they usually have a great gift in something, whether it be writing or engineering or math, and they are functioning, and usually people with Asperger's aren't diagnosed until they're late in life. So they bypass, you know, the adolescents, the teens, and then sometimes we're getting people that are diagnosed with Asperger's in their 20s and 30s just because they're able to function independently.
Mm-hmm. And what about the sort of the parents and all of this? What do you see as the most important issue for parents or caretakers with children with autism? And is there a sort of a recurring theme or issue that parents have in dealing with children with this condition?
You know, I think the biggest struggle with parents is, first of all, it's 24/7. You know, I have the luxury of going into people's homes for 2 hours at a time, 2 to 3 hours. So, you know, I get a break. Parents get very burnt out. So the number one thing I make sure is that they have a good support system, whether it be a husband, wife, mm-hmm. grandparents, friends that support them. So they at least get some type of respite at least once a week. The other thing is just because you get a diagnosis of autism really doesn't mean much. And I don't look at the clients that I work with as having a diagnosis. I look at the child as little Johnny, and little Johnny struggles with A, B, and C. However, he's great in these things. So for my clients, I set my expectations very, very high. You know, we have a motto in which autism has no limits, and we really stick by it. So
what does that motto mean?
So basically, we don't put limits on our kids at all. Mm-hmm. If I have a client who's in kindergarten, I expect them to do what a kindergarten would do. And I really don't place limits on any of the kids that I work with. I set the standards high, and when you do set the standards high, they will meet those standards. And that's a different approach of looking at things. As in terms of, I really try to encourage my parents, let's not look at the diagnosis. Let's look at what the skills are and what we're dealing with. And if you want your child to graduate from college or graduate from high school or have a job, that's our end goal. So these are the steps we need to take to get your child there. And I'm more of a cheerleader to parents, because it is a high burnout situation. But really assuring them that things are going to be okay.
And, is there any connection between, I know Jenny McCarthy was pushing this idea that vaccinations caused her child to have autism and all of that. Can you first sort of elaborate on what that premise is and if there's, if that's a fallacy or not?
You know, I really and truly don't know if it's true or if it's not true. Mm. You know, there is a theory that vaccinations do cause or kind of may be contributed to the cause of autism. Mm-hmm. What I do know, I'm not seeing it so much now, but when I first started in the field over 20 years ago, I would have clients that would say my child got their last round of vaccinations and then it was like lights out. And since we do know that there is a genetic component to autism, mm-hmm. maybe some kids may be predisposition to, you know, getting something if they're exposed to certain foods or certain vaccinations or the stuff in the vaccinations. But there's really no direct correlation. Although 20 years ago, I did have many, many clients say that my child got their last round of vaccinations and then it was lights out. They did have autism. I'm not hearing it so much now. So I really can't speak as how accurate that is.
Mm-hmm. And do you, what was it that sort of drew you to autism as a, you know, something that you wanted to sort of make your life's work?
I started as an undergrad. I took a course from Dr. Ivar Lobos, and he was a guru in the field.
Is it at UCLA?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was at UCLA, and he developed Screech Trial Training, which is a form of ABA, and that's one of the therapeutic approaches that I do with the kids that I work with. I took a course, and I ended up falling in love with it, and they had a hierarchy of courses that you could take and then eventually work at his clinic at the time as an undergrad, and so mm-hmm. I took the hierarchy of courses, and I fell in love with it more and more and more, and I got to see progress in kids, which was very rewarding. And back then, people would say, oh, you work with autistic kids. And I'm like, no, autistic. Nobody really knew what autism was. Mm-hmm. So it's been very fascinating to see the rise of autism and not understanding the causes of it, and people really advocating now and understanding what autism is. There's a month devoted to it. And I think it's been very rewarding and very fun to be in a field that has grown so much.
What, you know, there was this term when I was a kid, like mentally retarded, right? Which is sort of a, mm-hmm. you know, not appropriate, but sort of now, but like sort of a broad, it seemed like to me as a layperson, sort of a broad brush term for people with a variety of possible mental conditions and all of that. What did that term mean to people back then? Was it just sort of lumping everybody into this one group, or what was that?
I'm assuming yes. You know, I don't, you know, people ask why has autism increased over the years?
Right.
And I think it was misdiagnosed. There's some theories are that right now it's being overdiagnosed, which I can see. I do get clients that have a diagnosis of autism, and clearly they have some other stuff going on, as in terms of may have attachment disorder. They may be oppositionally defiant. But since autism is a spectrum, mm-hmm. I think people really want to give them that diagnosis so they can get the interventions that they need. Because studies have shown that if you can get a child in any type of early intervention, their prognosis and outcome will be better in their future.
Right. So it wasn't so much that autism, as you're saying, kind of just sort of came on the scene. It was more that, like, it was not diagnosed and it was mm-hmm. always there under the surface, or was being misdiagnosed.
Yeah. I think that. I really do. I think it may have been misdiagnosed. Because, you know, I remember being in school with people that were kind of a little strange, or I don't want to say strange, but, you know.
Yeah, just, different, right.
Just they didn't fit into the norm. And looking back now, I think that they were probably, they probably had autism and nobody really understood what it was back then.
What about, where does ADHD fall into this? I mean, that seems to be something that some would argue has been fairly heavily over-diagnosed. I don't know, mm-hmm. but in, mm-hmm. and is it related to autism in any way?
We do find kids that have autism sometimes also get a dual diagnosis, and they have ADD or ADHD, mm-hmm. and it's just the inability to focus, the impulse control. And it's really hard to decipher when you dual diagnose a kid, because you're trying to figure out, is that an ADD or is that autism? So it's really hard when working. Now, I've had very few clients that do come in, because I'm not a big fan of medication for kids. Mm-hmm. I try to avoid that.
Why is that? Like Ritalin and all that?
Because we don't know, you know, chemically what happens when the kids get older, what it does, the drug dependency and things like that, mm-hmm. What it's doing to their livers and stuff. So I really try and focus. We take a more behavioral approach and try and do everything we can to get kids to be successful without any type of medication. But there are instances in which medication really, truly does help. And you can see that once kids are off their medication, the inability to focus is I mean, they just cannot focus. They cannot sit in their seat. And it's more than, you know, children with autism have sensory processing disorder as well, but it's definitely more intense than that. It's like they can't focus, they can't talk, they can't even hold a conversation. So in those instances, medication is good. But some kids do get dual diagnosis. Mm-hmm. When they're diagnosed with autism as having ADD or ADHD as well.
Oh, I see. And what is it that you want the book to do for people? Like, I know sort of in a broad sense and sort of looking at it and researching this sort of a better understanding, but what is it that you feel this, what void is this book filling that you don't feel is being addressed in terms of people having a better understanding?
It's about autism acceptance. You know, a colleague of mine, Maylene Vasai, and I, we're in a lot of schools, both private and public. Mm-hmm. And many of our clients are mainstreamed into schools. So the idea of the book is we asked classrooms with typical kids, and it also included our clients with autism. Mm-hmm. We asked them 5 questions about friendship. And we gave them a white piece of paper and asked them to draw, write, talk about friendship. When we got the papers back, we realized we couldn't tell which kids had autism and which kids didn't. So that was a big indication, because there's this kind of myth that children with autism don't want to make friends, they don't know how to love, they don't mm-hmm. make eye contact, and that's the opposite. I mean, I've been in the field for 20 years. Mm-hmm. The majority of the kids that I work with want friendships, they long for friendships, they want to get invited to birthday parties, they want to play with kids on the playground, they truly want a best friend. So when you really look at the book, it's grades kindergarten through 7th grade, mm-hmm. and we don't identify which kids have autism or which kids don't, just so it just shows that, you know, children with autism, does it really matter? And they think and feel about friendships just like as any other quote-unquote typical kid. So what we're really trying to promote is autism acceptance and inclusion, and just because a child has a diagnosis doesn't mean they're quote-unquote different. And if you're more empathetic and compassionate and open it, give them a chance and they can develop a friendship just like you or I would.
Right. And when you say you got the papers back and you couldn't tell which child, you said you couldn't tell which child had autism and which child didn't. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah.
What kind of questions were they asking or were being asked?
So we asked them, how do you define friendship? How do you feel about friendship? What does a friend look like to you? And I can't remember the other two off the top of my head, mm-hmm. but we asked them, you know, just describe a friendship. How would you define friendship? And we asked the kids to draw about you know, friendships, to write about friendships. And we gave them just a blank piece of white paper. And, you know, there's these misconceptions that kids with autism can't draw, or they can't write, or they can't express their thoughts. Well, they express their thoughts just fine. And so when we got the papers back, and this is various grades, various classrooms, we didn't have the kids put their names on it. We really couldn't tell whose was whose. And that just shows that children with autism, number one, have the ability to draw and write and to express themselves. And number two is their ideas of friendship and love isn't different from their quote unquote typical peers.
Right.
So that's when we did get the papers back, we really honestly didn't know which ones were our clients and which ones weren't.
And was that something you expected to see, or did that come as a big surprise to you?
I don't think it was a big surprise. Maybe to other people it would, but I set the expectations high for my clients. So mm-hmm. I would expect them to blend in. We really work hard on mainstreaming kids.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit of a surprise when we got to the older grades. You know, the younger kids, it was great. They draw stick figures. They talk about friends. But as the kids were getting older and we saw those papers coming back, we really got to see, especially from our clients, how they felt, because sometimes they don't articulate it verbally, but it was interesting looking at their drawings and how they were able to express themselves via art and words that they used. That was very interesting and a revelation for us to see.
Right. Now you have this this campaign, a social media awareness mm-hmm. campaign called I Accept, and
mm-hmm.
elaborate on that a little bit for people and what you'd like to see happen with that.
Yes, you know, this is Autism Awareness Month, and awareness is one thing, but acceptance is another. And what we say is through awareness comes acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And for I Accept, we're teaching and we're trying to educate the public about autism. So instead of being judgmental, let's say that a child is tantruming at the store.
Right.
And there could be a possibility that child does have autism. So rather than shaming the parent and saying, oh, it's a result of bad parenting, ask the parent, hey, is there something I can do to help you to make this easier? You know, do you want to go in front of me in line? You know, what can I do to help? So we're really trying to educate the public about autism and ways that you can accept it. So we started a social media campaign over a year ago where we're asking people to take selfies with blue hands, blue lips, the shirts that we're selling, and just posting on their social media and hashtagging I Accept Autism, and also really practicing it in their daily lives of mm-hmm. ways that they can educate people, help people with autism, accept them, to create more compassionate and empathetic environment.
Oh, I see. Okay. And is it something that, do we know what causes autism, or is there anything traceable? Is there any preventive?
No, we don't know at this point. And mm-hmm. that's the mystery of it. It's a puzzle. That's why it's represented by a puzzle piece, because we truly don't know what causes it.
Yeah. It's I know the kids that my brother works with, the parents, they're just so far along. It's too difficult for the parents to be able to handle it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember my brother saying something similar to what you said, of sort of, you have to sort of set boundaries with, they do understand the boundaries. They do understand mm-hmm. This behavior is not acceptable, and then they will stop.
Right.
But there always has to be mm-hmm. a carrot, right? Like there has to be
mm-hmm.
something in it mm-hmm. for them, so to speak, for them to stop that behavior, just like a person mm-hmm. who's fully functional, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and eventually they do start developing intrinsic motivation like we have, but it takes a while. It takes years to really
What does that term mean? Say that again.
So, you know, like you were saying, that you have like that dangling carrot that prevents behaviors.
Right.
So we use reinforcement, whether it be, high fives, verbal reinforcement, good job, candy,
mm-hmm.
Those motivating factors. But eventually, you know, we as humans are motivated to do things internally. And, there was a theory that children with autism lack that internal motivation, meaning like they just won't get up just to get up. They have to be told, or there has to be something motivating like candy for them to perform, if you will. But over time, they do start developing that intrinsic motivation like you and I have. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, they're going to want to go to school, and they're going to want to get good grades, and they want to go to college. And the earlier the intervention that you can get for these kids, the better it is for them, mm-hmm. In their future.
And, people with autism can actually, if they're fairly high functioning, marry and have children and all of that, right?
Yes.
I mean, like,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of, it is on the spectrum. And then
yep.
Is there any risk that their children would be autistic, or if, let's say, two autistic people were marrying their kids?
There was a study or an article years back in Simi Valley, where you had parents who had Asperger's, or the fathers had Asperger's, and their kids had full-blown autism, meaning, mm-hmm. You know, that they were on the spectrum, and it wasn't the Asperger end of the spectrum. It was more, you know, level one or level two. So there is, what we do know, that there is a genetic component to it. But as in terms of, you know, if somebody has Asperger's, will they pass it down to their child? That there's studies done, but they're not fully studying. I think they're really trying to study what's causing it and, ways that we can prevent it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's fascinating, and it's really great work that you're doing. They're not, especially the ones that are severely, that are not high functioning. I've been to the hospital and seen my brother working with them, and it's tricky because sometimes you're dealing with people that just aren't even giving you anything, which is the most mm-hmm. difficult thing, as opposed to someone else who's mentally challenged with some other issues that at least they're sort of, you can tell if you're getting through to them. So my hat's off to you. It's really an amazing thing. And I think it's great that you're dedicated your life to this. And there's the book, which is Friendship Is, and people can get that everywhere, I would imagine, Amazon. Mm-hmm. And
Amazon. Yeah. If they just look it up on Amazon.
Okay.
They can get it on Amazon.
And the I Accept social media campaign is happening as we speak.
And
will be going on.
Website, www.iacceptautism.com, mm-hmm. and you can find out more about it on that.
All right, great. Well, people should all go do that. Pick up the book Friendship Is, and embrace these people, because they're not mm-hmm. too different than you and I. And everybody needs a little love, especially these days. So
yes.
But thank you very much for being on. I'd love to talk to you again in the future and track how this is going. So we'd love to have you back on sometime. So
thank you so much.
Yeah, and good luck with the book, and good luck with the social media campaign, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
All right, that was Dr. Nunez. I learned a lot about autism. She's to dedicate herself to that is amazing to me. My brother does it, working with autistic people and children. It's not necessarily easy, and it's way more important than being some idiot telling jokes like me. Speaking of which, how about that for a segue? April 13th to the 15th, this weekend, just a reminder, I'm at Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan. April 13th to the 15th, this Easter weekend. Come on out. And April 27th to the 29th, I'm at Comics Comedy Club in Mohegan Sun. Hope you can make it. It's up there in Connecticut. Really great casino, great club. And keep giving reviews of the podcast. Tell your friends about it. Spread the word. And have a great week, everybody. And enjoy your holiday weekend. And we'll see you next week. And here's a little joke for you.
So the other night, a rat runs right in front of me, carrying a whole green apple in his mouth. And I'm looking at that, I'm thinking, good for him, he's eating healthy. I'm working out, he's ripped. And I yell, like, go rat! Bring him here, he goes, he had his little earbuds in. You know this woman, a couple weeks ago, they found this woman, she had 40 frozen cats in her freezer. Exactly, but the same thing. Either that's a really big freezer, or she really knows how to pack a cat. I'm Italian. Now, if you hear you're Italian, they have one or two racist thoughts. They either think mafia or plastic on the furniture. Plastic on the furniture. I don't like stereotypes. Plastic on the furniture part, never applied. Our house is a pigsty garden. You know what I'm talking about. There's that one room you only go in at Christmas, right? There's plastic on the furniture, and there's a picture of the Pope, Jesus, and Frank Sinatra on the wall. This is how bad our house was. Someone broke into the house, they took the stereo. They just took another thing in the house. They were in and they were out. Cop comes over to take a police report, stands in the middle of the living room and goes, "Oh my God, what kind of an animal would make a mess like this?" I'm like, "Yeah, the guy broke in and ransacked the place. He left salami out all day, he threw a prawn, a lamb shit." I don't even know, like, what's racist, what stereotype. Like, if you're a European immigrant, you can make jokes about people who are European immigrants, like Italians, Irish, Polish, German, because we assimilated into the majority. My grandfather, when he came here in 1910, was a minority, but then especially, so you can make jokes. Oh, mafia's Italian, Irish drink, the Germans take over things. It's just kind of true. Right, so I don't know where the line is. I don't know, you can't make fun of Mexicans or Indians or Asians or Black. But a major hamburger chain had a stereotype racist commercial about Italians. They had the Italian Tuscan sandwich, and at the end of the commercial, the person bites into the sandwich, and after she bites into the sandwich, she goes, "Ooh, after I ate this Italian sandwich, I want to talk very loudly with my hands." See? And none of you reacted to that. It's common to with a Mexican chalupa special, and she did it, and went, "Ooh, after I ate this, I want to sneak into a country illegally and steal a job."
Everyone would be upset.
Chinese chicken salad. "Ooh, after I ate this Chinese chicken salad, I want to play the cello and do math." Everyone would be upset.
A Westwood One podcast production.